Many mystical groups take it for granted that there were in the earth in the ancient times superior orders of beings that were not human, that were the teachers of mankind. We cannot say that this is not so. We don't want to say that. But we do say that it is conceivable that these so-called records of superior orders of beings could definitely refer to a culture then existing. Because had these beings actually been superior, we probably would not have been in the presence of legends exactly like those that we have. If it was true that these beings that taught men were divine in the theological sense, that they were gods or angels or archangels, that they did actually represent a superhuman communication by revelation, then it is extraordinary indeed that all of these early records should be so conflicting concerning the essential integrity of these beings. We do not have at the beginning, any more than in this case of Plato's story, beings that are truly divine. We have beings in whose nature we find the elements of our common concept of a pagan theogenical hypothesis. Namely, we remember Zeus, divine. We find him taking the form of a bull and abducting Europa. We find this same Zeus in constant argument with his wife, who was extremely jealous of him because he was by nature of a philandering intention. This does not sound as though these old gods were divine in the strictest sense of the word. Now we go to other nations, and they rather remain a polyglot lot. The gods of India made mistakes. The gods of China were very autocratic. They combined great gifts with strange and inconsistent attitudes. Most of the deities, for example, of the prehistoric world, and we can take the Nordic Odin for a good example, were unable to foresee the consequences of their own actions. They set things in motion and then were dissatisfied. The gods of the ancient Olympian pantheon created man. Didn't like him. Wiped him out. They seem to have had combinations of factors. Among these same gods, there rose one, a great hero, a truly noble, semi-divine being, Prometheus. Prometheus took the fire of heaven in a hollow reed, and knowing that the gods were resolved to destroy mankind, he brought the fire of immortality to man, so that the gods could no longer destroy their creation. The gods turned upon him in righteous rage, chained him to the peak of Mount Caucasus, placed a vulture over him to devour his liver, and left him in agony for ages. Peculiar. Something not totally divine about the whole subject. There's only one answer that appears to meet all of the problems, and that is that these myths have some ground in a reality. That man, perhaps perfectly willing to accept all the attitudes and characteristics of these deities as sacred, because they were beyond his comprehension, still maintained a certain record of things heard and seen. This record drifted into myth and fable, but still the record seems to show the survival of a strong humanity in the symbolism of these creating deities. That these ancient pantheons could well have represented great colonizing powers. And if you ask the man of Tunisia, or the man of Libya, or the man of Algiers today, what he thinks of the nations that colonized in his areas, he is apt to give some rather mixed accounts also. There seems to be some doubt, for example, how popular the French are in North Africa at the moment. There is considerable doubt as to how popular the British were in India for a long time. Now, the intelligent Indian is perfectly willing to admit that he has learned a great deal from the people he didn't like. And if 10,000 years from now this whole episode is mythologized, as could occur, even our best tape recordings won't last that long, it's quite conceivable that reports concerning the ancient masters of races would be as interesting, confused, and inconsistent as those of the theologies out of the past which we hear of today. Not long ago, a considerable student of religious matters pointed out something which was also picked up and mentioned by Sigmund Freud in one of his books, namely that in religious tradition in Europe particularly and in the Near East, there has always been two traditions. We find this in the ancient Semitic faith, where we have the two faiths, the followers of one deity, which is called the J group, following the deity we now call Jehovah, and the other called the E group, following the collective deity now called Elohim, both terms appearing in the Bible. It is quite possible, however, that although the names have since been confused, the two distinct systems of religion were originally involved. Freud thinks so. Others have also discovered a very important thing, that from the earliest religious records that we know, two religious systems have been in conflict. One is essentially monotheism, and every religion has at its root the worship of one invisible God. The other is polytheism or pantheism, the veneration for secondary deities. These secondary deities, in many instances, gradually obscured the primary divinity. But wherever we had the Greeks worshipping their Olympian pantheon, we also had them worshipping a secret and hidden god unnamed, superior to anything in that pantheon. And the answer might well be that originally man had a concept of an essential religion, and that this religion continued, but upon it came gradually the engraftings of the hero lines and the mythological lines due to semi-historical records. That by degrees, the ancient teachers, the colonizers, the master race of that time, became confused with deity. But the confusion was never complete. Always the concept of the one, unchanging and eternal deity remained. In the Scandinavian rites, we have Odin, the most powerful of the hero gods. But behind him is another deity, unnamed, only known as Allfather, All Father, the Great One, the one in whom even Odin's power was as nothing. This All Father, the one behind, disappears almost completely in the great age of legendary, but it is still there. So it is quite possible that what we term our colonizing continent gradually came to be confused with gods, that the mysterious heavenly world became identified or identical with the golden city of Atlantis. This was the city of the golden gate, the city four square. This was the wonderful heavenly city, perpetuated and remembered in most myths. But it was not necessarily the divine city, because ancient peoples, certainly Plato was well aware that the Olympian gods were not the creators of the universe. He tells us so. He shows why it is mathematically impossible that they should be. He places them, therefore, on a lower level, giving them creativity over certain departments of life, but not the supreme department. The identification of the gods with stars and the gradual development of the concept that these stars represented arts and sciences, systems of culture, and later the seven parts of the soul, and finally the sensory perceptions of man, all of these ties seem to point out that we are dealing with more than one level of ancient tradition. So we have in religious tradition as we know it not only a universal account of the deluge, but also the fact that this deluge swept away not only a mortal world, but an order of gods. In the Nordic mysteries, for example, the destruction at the Gotadamarum, the twilight of the gods, was not a destruction of the world, but of the gods. And it is inconceivable that this strange, sad, melancholy story of divine beings who were not divine, of gods who were selfish and tyrannical, of deities who brought down upon themselves a common ruin, the selfishness of the Teutonic Wotan when he makes his and breaks his pledge to the Nibelungen, his effort to steal the ring from Fafnir, and all of the subterfuges involved in this story leading finally to the destruction of the gods. If they were truly gods, they could not be destroyed. This destruction, therefore, obviously relates, if it has historical foundation, and most legends do, for mythology is the history of prehistoric time. These relate to a people regarded as sacred, held to be divine, but nevertheless subject to evil, subject to death, and subject to the ultimate dissolution of their civilization. The moment we begin to think in these terms, we begin to put together pieces that will be of considerable value to us. We know also that if the Atlantic pattern gained control of European thinking, that there should be old vestiges, old remains that would tell us something about it. We find evidence supporting this concept in Andalusia and in certain areas of Spain. Also, we know that on rare occasions there are tides on the western coast of Spain. These tides are most extraordinary. They occur only at rare intervals, but under some conditions it is possible to walk dry shod as far as 7 miles out from the normal shoreline. There are very rare tides of this kind. These were the types of tides which in the Mediterranean area resulted finally, as is said, in Aristotle committing suicide because he could not explain them. In any event, searches for Atlantean vestiges have gone out at these low tides to look for sea, if the sea had concealed anything. 6, 7, 8 miles off the coast of Spain, human artifacts of a high order have been found. These artifacts are totally different from anything relating to the historical background of Spanish archaeology. They represent symbols, figures, designs, mostly in bronze and ancient metals. And it is now estimated, therefore, that these bronze remains must be as old, if not older, than what we call the Cro-Magnon today. Yet we have no record that he worked in bronze. It would be incredible to us that he did. In the Sahara Desert have been dug up examples of tempered bronze, tempered so successfully that that a real cutting edge could be achieved, a strong edge, a useful edge. Yet the tempering of copper has only been discovered in comparatively recent times. The ancient evidences of these arts and sciences, the relics of them, would correspond somewhat with Plato's accounts and with those of other early writers, for it has been assumed for a long time that the Atlanteans did master the use of bronze, and that in some ways the tipping of the Bronze Age, as it was called, into the Age of Iron had symbolic bearing upon the destruction of their continent. All of these relics, however, are not as really interesting to us as, for example, we know from ancient mythologies that among the kings of Atlantis there was one that ruled a state on the extreme eastern end of that continent. And in the old mythological records he is called Gades. And he was one of the members of the family of Atlas. Gades is remaining to us. We know who Gades is now, or what Gades is. It is the city of Cadiz in Spain, named for him. He was an Atlantean king. How did the Spanish city come to pick up this legend? Why do we also find in the area around this city extraordinary examples of volcanic upheaval and evidences of ancient culture far earlier than anything to be discovered in more distant parts of the same country? Bit by bit, these things have to be fitted together. But all the fitting tells us one thing, that somewhere in the background, there were many myths, many legends, which have resulted in the naming of ancient areas. And that this naming of ancient areas seems to show a broad knowledge of something. Some years ago, a man named Preston, in his work, The Great Pyramid, a book on the Great Pyramid, New Light on the Great Pyramid. I guess his name was Parsons, not Preston. But in any event, he brings into his book something that is quite intriguing. He shows a map of the world, the astronomical map, laid on the terrestrial map. He makes his contact by tying the celestial constellation of the Nile with the terrestrial Nile, assuming that at some remote period, the heavenly map and the earthly map coincided, following an ancient belief that there is, they say, a flower in the field for every star in the sky, but more particularly, these great land areas. If you fit the celestial map over the terrestrial map, as the Chinese did in their famous bronze terrasphere on the wall of the observatory in Peking, which was taken to Berlin after the Boxer Rebellion but later returned, you find that the heavens placed upon the earth give us some very interesting things in the line of correspondences. If we do that, the constellation of the Great Bear falls over Russia. Why? No one knows. The constellation of the Eagle falls over the United States. The great constellation Serpens falls over Central America, where the worship of the serpent has been noted for ages. All parts of this terrestrial celestial correspondence map seems to indicate that the creators of the star groups had some kind of a knowledge of geography, that they were not unaware that there were land areas, and that at some prehistoric time these land areas had been reached or charted. How, we do not know. We know also that Plutarch, in his Voyages, describes a Greek expedition. The description, the detail of this description of navigation was analyzed mathematically in terms of the sailing of boats. The modern analysis was made within the last 50 years to try to find out from the detailed description left by the ancient Greek navigators where they had gotten to, allowing for their own measurements of how many equivalents to our miles they sail in one direction, then for so many days in another direction, and following exactly as far as possible not only their course, but at the end what they found. it would seem that these Greek navigators at a very ancient time navigated as far as the St. Lawrence River and went up that river, perhaps as far as a boat could go. That they were, and then also traveled down the coast of America. We have no authentic records of this, except this record, which was then held to be purely mythological. But taking the charts and measuring the journey, it seems that they reached that area. Now, we have no way of knowing what others have done. This whole idea that this half of the world was unknown depends entirely upon our own concept. Now, what kind of a people must we assume these Atlanteans to have been? Here we go into a whole group of possible explanations. From the standpoint of the diffusion of peoples and the remnants that today seem to bear witness to this ancient motion, we are apparently in the presence of a Mongolian people, what we would term something between the Egyptian and the American Red Indian, the Mongolian of China and Siberia. He seems to belong to this group of people. Therefore, it would be interesting to discover, if possible, where Mongolian blood can be found in Europe. Of course, we know approximately where to look for it, but this is a comparatively late mixture. We know that the host of Genghis Khan brought Mongolian blood to the back door of Europe, certainly as far as the Slavic countries, and that he and his descendants during the 12th and 13th centuries scattered Mongolian blood throughout Eastern Europe. But we also have a lot of other things to think about, namely the evidence that increases constantly that in the remote background, practically every European stock has Mongolian blood. We don't like to go into it too much in detail, but there is evidence of Mongolian blood in Ireland. In the so-called 100% German Aryan, he is loaded with it. It is even quite abundant in the Latin peoples. It is present in Spain. And it is quite evident that it commixes in North Africa, producing a whole series of mixtures. Of course, it is all through Asia, so that Mongolian blood is to be found on both sides of the Western Hemisphere. And, of course, your American Indian also is a strong Mongolian, a point that has never been questioned. This diffusion, therefore, of ancient peoples and the fact that these strains are consistently being submerged in most European countries, and that these strains go back much further than we generally believe. In fact, it is believed rather historically that the historical man whom we know as Odin in Scandinavia came from Scythia, and that he came as an Asiatic to Scandinavia. The Greeks claim that their Orpheus was an Asiatic, and the Egyptians say that their Osiris came originally from India. So all these things go back. And as we go back behind the rise of the great Anglo-Saxon Teuton complex of peoples, we find underneath, holding them up, this mysterious Mongolian atlas who holds modern humanity on its shoulders. More research is necessary in this field. But the belief in general has long been that what we call our Atlantean was perhaps nearer to the Mongol than any other type that we know today. That therefore the possibility of his disappearing as a great unit of culture in the Atlantic Ocean era or the Atlantic region may well have released minority groups as the Celts and the Anglo-Saxons and the Aryan Semites from what had previously been subservience. that it was the loss of these master powers that gave a tremendous incentive to the rise of European culture, for which also we have no reasonable explanation. We simply do not know. The Druids had two colleges in France. These colleges, one of which was the great school of Bibracus, taught so much of learning that it was to the amazement of Caesar. The Romans had nothing comparing to the great universities of the Druids. These universities, however, have vanished from all memory, apparently. They disappeared. But what they taught came from very ancient sources. And we know that such doctrines as rebirth and evolution were known to the Druids. In fact, they borrowed money in one life and gave a receipt promising to pay it back in the next, which indicates a very high degree of faith, particularly on the part of the individual who accepted the note. Today, we trace most of these beliefs to Asia. Now, we have another problem that's a rather pretty and subtle one. Assuming that Asia attained a comparatively high cultural level at an early period, and your Indian records might assume it, we must then explain our Aleutian Straits migrations and our Bering Sea migrations. At what time, according to the conservative men of the field, did this migration from Asia take place that was to populate the Western Hemisphere with its traditional red man? We have to look carefully. This migration must have occurred before Asia attained a cultural platform which we associate with its classical era. Had it attained its classical definition, it would have brought this information with it and would not have left the entire North American hemisphere as far as the Mexican border without a calendar. It couldn't have happened. These things would have come along. And also many doctrines would have advanced much more completely, and we would not have had a great culture like Asia producing a nomadic culture like our North American Indians. Therefore, our American Indian possesses the rudiments of Asiatic shamanism, but he does not possess it in a highly developed form. Therefore, he has to have brought it, the primitive part, with him, and had to have left the homeland before the more highly advanced part was known to his own people. Then cut off, theoretically, he could have been forced to grow slowly, achieving over a period of perhaps several thousand years the final culture which he attained in the Great Iroquois League. If the Iroquois League lasted for 50 years longer, Europe could not have conquered America. This situation points out something else. Down further along our shores, in the Mexican, Toltec, Aztec, Maya complex, we have an entirely different people, structurally and racially. Here we have a people with a great culture, a culture that confounded Montezuma and left the early Jesuits that accompanied him speechless and caused them finally to reform their own calendar from that of Mexico. Here was a people that did not wander across the Bering Straits or the Aleutian Island chain. These people came with an achievement. Had they migrated, they would have left their records from Alaska to Mexico, but they did not. Migration could not have been rapid enough in those days for them not to have left long, enduring records the entire length of our coast. They didn't. They say themselves they didn't come from there. They say that they came from an entirely different area. They came from the east. If they came from the east, they did not come from any nation that we know of in historic time. And yet we have every reason from their calendar to assume that they arose in ancient time from a very highly civilized group. They were not Egyptians. They were not Phoenicians. They were not Assyrians, or Chaldeans, or Babylonians. And certainly they were not Irishmen. They came from an entirely different cultural stream. This great Central American civilization arrived in this continent building cities, raising temples, creating buildings 2,000 feet long, pyramids with such perfect drainage that if you spill a glass of water at the top, it'll go directly to the bottom, orienting them as perfectly as the Egyptian pyramid. Yet they were not Egyptian. They were something else. They had a homeland, and a homeland which was rich in arts, rich in cultures. They came from the east, from great cities. Go back and figure the time when they came from there. Allowing for the conservative concept of modern archaeologists. One thing is evident. They did not come from Europe since the Roman Empire. Or someone would have remembered them. Someone would have noted it. No people strong enough to have produced the great empire of Mayapan could have detached itself from the Italy of the Medicis or the Rome of the Caesars and not been remembered. We might say they could have come from some other area, such as Gaul. But at that time, these people were dressed in the skins of animals. They were not your Maya empire. They could not have come in the days between the rise of the Roman kingdoms, 600 B.C. They did not come from Greece. There's nothing remotely Grecian about them. They speak no language that is known in the old world. They use no alphabet from Europe. Yet they came from the east. Where? They tell us distinctly that they did come from the east. There is no other explanation for them. There is no trace of them coming down our Western Americas. They certainly didn't come from Patagonia. There is nothing that tells us that they could have come directly from Asia. They tell us themselves that they came from the east. Their great hero god, later, to follow the pattern, came from the east, from the land of the seven colors. Later, when Cortez came from the east, they declared him to be their god returned because he had followed the same route as their ancient peoples. These things tell us that this people arose somewhere this side of Europe and the far side of Mexico. They didn't come from the Azores. They were not the people of Madeira, and they certainly were not the ancient inhabitants of the West Indies. Where did they come from? Seemingly, we have no record. Within historic time, they did not come from Africa. They have none of the bloodstream. How did they get where they got? There seems to be one point that is made out of this, that some cultural center existed that could produce a people that could build a city like Chichen Itza, in which the public buildings are some of them 5 miles apart. It is estimated that the city of Chichen Itza, if laid out architecturally and completed, according to the existing remains, would have been large enough to house 3 million people. Where did they come from? They tell us. But we have to deny it because we can't find the land they spoke of, even though they tell us it's anger. But if we can imagine from their calendars that they did move in, they moved in already rich. They moved in upon a previous people, Aboriginal. And we have the same situation here that we had in other parts of the world. Two layers of culture, one built upon the other, like the Aryas of India moving down into the Dravidian culture of the Indo-Gangetic Plain. These things move, and they move from the west, from the east to the west, through some region, some area, unknown. That these people could have navigated a distance is true, that a whole civilization moved the entire width of the Atlantic is unlikely. The lands of Mutt must once have been there. Now, the strange glory of the great Western culture, the cities which they built, have in some way fired the imagination of many thinkers to assume that this whole mode of architecture, this whole psychology of life, was the shadow, the dying remnant of the Atlantean. That another remnant of this, moving in the opposite direction and striking the Mediterranean culture, resulted in Egypt, but that these two forks had already separated. Therefore, in certain things there is a common heritage. In other things, however, there is no heritage. Both use glyphs, but the glyphs cannot be completely deciphered in terms of each other. There are reminiscences, but there are differences. It is quite possible that the Western culture, the magnificent city of Mexico described by Cortes, the city that was a fairyland of beauty, and yet a city in which a strange warlikeness, human sacrifice, and all these things abounded, could well have been the remnant of this decadent Atlantean culture which was wiped out for its cruelties. We do not know, but the dream moves in that direction. The thinking seems to tell us that there was this central core there. If this existed, as by reasonable hypothesis, then we know that the people who reached the Western Hemisphere sometime, perhaps between the beginning of the Christian era and 1,000 years before that, that period in there, that these people reached this Western Hemisphere from the remnants and vestiges of something. And there are reports and records to be found that would indicate that parts of the Antilles, as we call it, parts of the area around the West Indian group were submerged comparatively recently. There is indication that in the area which we call the Sargasso Sea at the present time, the graveyard of ships, that there were large areas which were not submerged until well within the period of history. That these submergences may have been as late as 1,000 to 2,000 years before the beginning of the Christian era. It is possible that these formed parts of the land bridges that carried these people from some unknown homeland of still earlier vintage. Here again, then, if we posit our Atlantean as we find him in Plato, assuming him to have existed some 12,000 years before the beginning of the Christian era, and in this period coming to the conclusion of his culture, what is behind him? We must assume that behind him was a long history. And this is also implied, but not analyzed, by Plato. These people had to rise. They had to come to authority and power. Again, they had to be taught by gods and heroes of a still more ancient time. What we probably have not recognized and have never given serious consideration to is that man has been on this earth much longer than even the most optimistic anthropologist believes. That there have been many cultures, but that the natures of these cultures were such that for some of them at least, surviving artifacts might be comparatively rare. We have reasons to assume, for example, if we can believe our studies of anatomy and physiology, that primitive man may have lived here as a comparatively rational being without leaving architectural remains. That's something we've never taken into consideration at all. Namely, that what we call our stream of culture, which has largely been a stream marked by monuments. Wherever we have gone, we have left a monument, whether it was the pyramid or Stonehenge. Wherever we have gone, we have also left carved bones, inscribed rocks, human remains in some cultural form. This represents, however, a direction of energy. It is quite possible that man could have existed, as the legends tell us, at a time when these things were not necessary. That he could have had an entirely different orientation, and that this orientation was lost to him by what is called symbolically the fall. That this fall may also have historical meaning. That it represents not necessarily the punishment of a crime, but a reorganization of man's powers. Possibly going back, and this may psychologically have great importance in the course of time, to the beginning at which apparently the human being, together with most other creatures of nature, was hermaphrodite. That it was not until the division of the sexes that the intellectual polarization of man began to force him into an objective condition. This is indicated by most of the scriptural writings of the world. That therefore there came a time when man, who had been a peculiarly complete creature, and being complete, did not suffer from the psychosis which we call the need for civilization, had an entirely different way of fulfilling the consciousness instincts of his own nature. Particularly if we wish to assume, as the Tibetan does, that in a remote time he possessed an internal organ of orientation by means of which he had the power of direct knowing. And that this power of direct knowing lies at the root, giving or bestowing the primordial impulse by means of which all motion of knowledge as we know it had its origin. If this being possessed knowing, as Buddha points out, he would not have done in that state what man does now. In the first place, our entire motion has been toward knowledge and toward security. So survival and wisdom have been the supreme quest of man since the dawn of the motions of civilization as we know them. Had man at some ancient time possessed wisdom and known security beyond any question of doubt, he would have been and remained static in that state. Something had to happen. Something had to unbalance man's internal psychic faculty equilibrium, making it suddenly necessary for him to follow the admonition of Genesis, to go forth and to earn his bread with the sweat of his brow. Something had to drive him out of the paradisical region which was perhaps his primordial home. It is quite possible, therefore, that man, different of appearance, different of structure, different of texture, but still the seed from which modern man was to come, at some remote time possessed a total internal awareness, and that this total internal awareness has retired to become his unconscious, and that what we call evolution or growth today is this internal awareness breaking through slowly as a result of the gradual retirement, refinement of certain organs, certain structures, which for thousands of years have inhibited the expression of this internal totality. Plato intimates as much, so does Hesiod in his Theognomy. These possible explanations might also explain how and why the Atlantean mystery was possible in Atlantis. How, at a remote time, a culture which, according to Plato, once lived at peace and according to law, suddenly became lawless. As a result of its lawlessness, certain things happened. Cain, the fratricide, after he had slain his brother, went forth and became the builder of cities. This has never been exactly understood. It could well be that it was the destruction of certain psychic content, or the suppression of it, which suddenly sent man desperately into the course he now knows, the course that has left behind it 7,000 years of historical empires, rising, falling, disappearing. And with all of this, man remaining essentially insecure. Had it been possible to assume this, we might then postulate that the Atlantis of Plato and the Atlantis of the demigods of mythology, the Atlantis with its huge monolithic monumental remains scattered about the earth, that this Atlantis was the product itself of a very long period of conditioning, that by degrees as Plato says, here war was first discovered, here men first disobeyed. That gradually, in the course of the primordial development of a kind of specialized life on this planet, man passed out of instinctive control, such as was possessed by animals, but probably a higher and more intuitive form of it, and passed into this state in which he had to depend upon submerged intuition. And this submerged intuition became instinct. And he began to seek around him for the things that were really within him. And once he started this, we can understand why civilization galloped on its way, like some mysterious symbolic centaur with the head and shoulders of a man and the body of a horse. This civilization, therefore, represents a special condition arising, making possible the gradual accumulation of artifacts. Prior to this, there may have been a being that needed no artifacts. As surely as there existed upon the earth in those days countless creatures, in addition to those whose fossilized remains are known to us, only certain type of creatures could leave fossils. These did, but there were other forms that did not. The nature of man is not known for any of this vast background, and we do not seem to be catching up to him very rapidly. Thus, out of a long, dim background, the rise of an Atlantean culture can be hypothecated. We can see it emerging until it finally reaches a tremendous achievement. Now, the destruction of Atlantis may or may not be regarded as a mortal incident. It is quite conceivable that this destruction went on over an incredible period of time. That perhaps at times the continent increased in size, at other times it decreased. A considerable piece of the coast of Chile disappeared in our own lifetimes. It made a couple of inches in the newspaper, that was all. We have no interest in these minor changes, unless we happen to live in them. But changes are continuously happening. Our eastern seaboard is changing constantly with a tendency to slowly submerge. It will not happen in our time or in our descendants' time. But if we look back upon this continent 100,000 years from now, it probably will not have the present shape. It is assumed as possible from existing conditions that 100,000 years from now, our Pacific coast will be inland. Here's an opportunity for further subdivision. But all these changes are forever happening. They happened in Atlantis. The continent was constantly differing in the formation and distribution of its allotments. But slowly out of it, there appears to have come a pattern of seven, some say 10 islands. And that these islands, including a comparatively large region, Posidonis, remained for a long time, perhaps suffering from problems not dissimilar from the Japanese to the Japanese islands, where population problems are acute, and where the peoples attempted to escape to the mainland and the colonization of Manchuria and helped to precipitate a very difficult political situation. What is going to happen to the Dutch East Indies? Who cares about Java unless you happen to be a Javanese? And yet at the moment, Java is the most densely populated area on the face of the earth, averaging 700 persons to the square mile for the entire island. What are we going to do with these people? They're increasing constantly. There may have been great problems of that kind that we know nothing about long ago. The migrations of these peoples over great periods of time, and finally, the destruction of the great capital center, which was still the homeland of all these peoples. Imagine Atlantis spreading out and casting a vast empire, ruled over, as was the British Empire, by a small group of islands. This island kingdom, this center, by its gradual destruction and its ultimate sudden annihilation, If we sit down and study it, analyze the possibility of migrations from Atlantis, perhaps covering 100,000 years or 1,000,000 years, moving into various other areas, meeting ultimately with further later migrations of their own peoples, mingling with primitive or pre-Atlantean groups existing. Here we have a tremendously complicated history, a history that could touch 1,000 nations in 1,000 different ways, bringing one thing to one people and one to another. Some of these groups, like the American Indians, might have migrated from their homeland before the rise of Atlantean culture, so that little but myth, legend, and bloodstream remained. Others may have been among the last, and the first and the last meeting may have slain each other because they no longer recognized any kinship. It is all a very confusing and fantastic situation, and out of it arises a little isolated community like the Basques, between France and Spain, people without a history, with an unknown language, with a completely and totally isolated culture, surviving. Other groups of a similar nature are to be found in other places, as in the Nilgiri Hills of India. Here we have also records on our Latin American coast, particularly northern parts of South America, of blonde, blue-eyed Indians who flourished there 3,000 or 4,000 years ago. Who were they? Examination of their skulls remains most discomforting. Their brain capacity was equal to ours. Where did they come from? No one knows. We have to place behind our present anthropological and ethnological concept some proven pattern of human motion in a dark period before history. We cannot have nothing back there but the missing link. We cannot have nothing there but a hairy human anthropoid giving birth out of his own wisdom to Greek philosophers. There has to be something. And this something has to be a bridge that is strong, long, old, and important. It has to show thousands of years of traditional culture within itself. Even if the Atlantic theory or Atlantis theory of Plato does only one thing for us, that thing, it seems to me, may ultimately be more than sustained, although we speak only from reason and not from fact. Namely, that we have got to be prepared to discover ancient cultures, prehistoric cultures, that can explain our present achievements. We also, perhaps, will learn from them the key to the riddle of our own. And we will discover, perchance, how it happened that we took the course that has led us into this strange and difficult procedure. We may also discover where certain basic errors crept in, where we followed false motions, and in so doing have built false foundations. By so doing, by studying, by analyzing and observing, we might even be able to restore, ultimately, the primitive purpose of man, which is now lost to us. For here is for the primitive man with a purpose and no way of attaining it. And here is a modern man with every means of attainment at his disposal and no purpose. These tremendous intervals, these inconsistencies must be reconciled. And to do it, we must have a new concept of the human race. And if the Atlantis theory opens to us the possibilities of this new concept, even though the stories we now have may be many of them incorrect, if they reveal a line of thought that may unfold for us the origin of our species and leave us free from this terrible belief that a few thousand years ago, we were untutored savages hunting for fire, and recognize that the man that we know on Earth today is the product of vast periods of growth, unfoldment, and that nature has concentrated this effort for a reason. And to attain this reason, we must not be like the lemmings, who simply swim out into the sea and drown, because they always have. Man makes mistakes because he always has.
always has. This he cannot afford to do. I'm making a mistake now. It's 2 minutes past time, but I always have made the mistake, so you'll excuse me if we do it on this occasion. Now, I'd like to, before you leave, I'd like to call...